First Samuel chapter 17, David and Goliath. There are four lessons that I want in particular to underline in this marvelous story as follows. First of all, the symbolism of this heroic act standing at the beginning of David's story. Secondly, the faith of David and the weak things of God. Thirdly, the typology, if you can use that old-fashioned word, and the illustration of the gospel that we find in this story. And finally, the giants of today. First of all, then, the symbolism. I think we have to notice the amount of space given to this story. Is it merely the fact that it signalized a major defeat for the Philistines? I think that is hardly the case. It seems to me rather that under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, the writer has given a symbolic indication in placing this heroic deed at the beginning of David's story, an indication of the kind and quality of David's reign in contrast to Saul's, as one in which the divine power was to be signally at work, overruling all human circumstances in the furtherance of the divine will. Now, the contrast with Saul's story is indeed a very marked one and complete one. Saul was anointed as one who was head and shoulders above his fellows, a man among men, a choice, as we've seen in our studies, in line with the thoughts and desires of the people, to be like other nations. Human standards of selection. And Saul's first act as the Lord's anointed was a campaign of war against the Ammonites on these standards. We read of it in chapter 11. But with David, it was different. He was anointed not on human standards. A chapter or two further back, you remember, we had the words, "Man looketh on the outer appearance, but God looketh on the heart." And David's first campaign here was not conducted on human standards, but on a totally other principle, that of faith and trust in the living God and in the power of his name. Look, for example, at the faith that is expressed in such verses as verse 26. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Verse 36. This uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. And verses 45 and 46. Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And so the message here, therefore, is that of a man after God's own heart, living in faith and trust in Him. And this is to be the pattern of all David's reign. There is, of course, further symbolism in the story, and we shall look at this later on also, in the typology that the chapter affords. In this regard, that the war with the Philistines recorded here represents a fresh incursion on their part against Israel. They were a very resilient enemy, were they not? Coming again and again against the people of God. And that surely reminds us that the battles we fight in the Christian life against the powers of darkness are never won once for all. You remember how we're told in the New Testament the devil left Jesus for a season after the temptation of the wilderness, only to return later with renewed wiles and subtlety. And that's how it is in the Christian life also. And this attack by the Philistines seems to have taken Saul at a great disadvantage, throwing him and his army into confusion and terror. And it's worthy of note to mention the low-spiritedness of the army and the demoralized attitude that they clearly had. This was at least in part due to the fact that Saul, their commander-in-chief, was out of joint spiritually. And that's sometimes how we are more demoralized than we ought to be when pressures come upon us. Our spiritual resources have been depleted by our being out of joint with God. But at the same time, we do need to recognize that this was a major crisis, presenting an urgent danger. And once again, this illustrates times in spiritual life when the devil seems to confront us with perils of such monumental dimensions that the stuffing is knocked out of us. There are situations like that, when we just feel totally overwhelmed. But man's extremity is God's opportunity, as the saying goes. And in the story of Israel, at this transitional point, the crisis that faced them was the travail out of which a new stage was to emerge in God's dealings with them. The victory that David was to win against Goliath and the Philistines was, as it were, a kind of new birth into the forward-moving purposes of God. And you know, crisis points can sometimes be points of new departure in God's work, in the providence and mercy of God. And it may be that there's a lesson there for the church today, in the crisis in manpower and falling roles and so on that we are facing. It may be that we need to view these crisis points in that way. That's the first thing then, the symbolism in the story, and it's very real, and we mustn't miss it. The second is the faith of David, and what the New Testament calls the weak things of God. It's very noticeable in the story the casual circumstances which led to David's going to the army of Israel. The simple and unostentatious provision of food for the sons of Jesse, who were in Saul's army at the time. And it's the naturalism and the unobtrusiveness of God's working that is so impressive. There's always a rightness and effortlessness about it. Now, this is one of the very marked things that we see in different parts of the scriptures, in the Old Testament and in the New, about major developments in the work of God. There is the beautiful idyllic story in the early chapters of Exodus about the baby that was born into a Levite family, Moses. There is a story of Samuel's birth at the beginning of this book that we studied some time ago. The pastoral nature, the unobtrusive nature, the very natural situation in which this child was born, a woman's longing, a natural longing, the most natural thing in the world. Hannah desperately wanted a baby. And out of that very human situation, God's new thing took place. And this is how it was here also. David was sent by his father with provender to his brethren in the army. And incidentally, in view of the point made earlier about God looking on the outward appearances, not on the outward appearances, but on the heart, we see how realistic this was in the case of Jesse's sons. Because you may remember how Eliab, the firstborn, was described, and Samuel said, "Surely this is God's man. Look what an upstanding, towering man he was." And it was then that God said, "Man looketh on the outward appearance, God looks on the heart." Because for all his uprightness of stature and nobility of mien, his heart was just like Saul's, corroded with jealousy against David, and his sharp and unceremonious and contemptuous dismissal of David is very significant. Verse 28, Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men, and his anger was kindled against David, and he said, "Why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle." What Eliab was doing, in fact and in effect, was dismissing the Lord's anointed. Now he knew, because he was present at David's anointing by Saul, and obviously the whole thing was still rankling in his heart. But this is a very dangerous position to be in. I have known men who should have known better, giving expression to amused and contemptuous dismissal of a man whom God has used and owned in the ministry in very significant ways. And I have had fun being poked at him because of his nature, because of some of his mannerisms, and they treat him as a kind of joke. But he's a man whose ministry has produced many conversions, and a man whose ministry has produced quite a number of candidates for the ministry who are in notable ministries today. That was Eliab's attitude to David. He was dismissing the Lord's anointed. And that's not a light thing for a man to do. Now, David's faith, as expressed in these verses I've already made reference to, and particularly verses 32 to 37 in his encounter with King Saul. Saul said to David, "Thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." And David said to Samuel, "Thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock, and I went out after him and smote him," and so on. David said, "The Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine." Now, this is something very remarkable. In the last analysis, of course, we must attribute this to the fact that this was the Lord's anointed who was speaking. But how was he so absolutely sure of God? Well, we're not told in the record, but it's not difficult, surely, to realize that David's task of watching the sheep in the wilderness is analogous to the task that Moses was given, watching the sheep in the wilderness. John the Baptist was in the deserts until the day of his appearing to Israel. Joseph spent so many years in prison before rising to power. And there are some similarities between David and Joseph. The jealousy of the brethren is evident in both the stories. Well, what sort of training would David have had? I don't think that it's stretching the point to suggest that David was the fruit of Samuel's ministry in those days. I think Samuel had an immense impact on the whole nation by the quality of his ministry over these 25 or 30 years as he led the people back into fellowship with the living God. And I believe David was blessed in that ministry and by that ministry. But there can be no doubt at all that here was a man, young as he was. We shouldn't overestimate the youthfulness of David. The word youth or young man is an elastic term in the Hebrew, as the scholars point out to us. But one has only to think of some of the Psalms. We don't know if they were composed during these early days, but many were indeed composed in the days of his trials and tribulations on his way to the throne. And doubtless many of the thoughts expressed in these Psalms, which breathe the essence of personal faith and personal experience, were thoughts born and nurtured in the early days. Now, I think that there's something very important here. The learning, the spiritual learning of early days is so crucial and all important for the whole of our later life. Because the teaching of earlier days can condition all one's future for weal or woe. I personally can think back to the disciplines and battles of early days, and I cannot thank God enough that I was privileged to sit under a living ministry that shaped and fashioned my life and taught me to know God. And if there is a message here at all, it is this. And this is perhaps another emphasis for young folk. Do not waste your early Christian years. Do not fritter them away on superficialities and trivialities, but get to know God. If our work has had a particular function, I would say that this is one of the functions that it has had over the years, to establish young Christians in the faith and stimulate them and urge them in face of the disciplines of life to get grounded in the faith once delivered to the saints. We cannot serve a God we do not really know. And it takes time to get to know him. And if we do not get to know him as we ought, then we will run about doing things he has not asked us to do, expending energy worthlessly. And allowing promising Christian material to run to seed through lack of waiting upon God. Now, when there is this waiting on God, there is an identifying with the divine pattern in the work of God. For there will be a recognition of a principle on which God works, in that he chooses the weak things of the world to confound the mighty. And I think this is the point about David's discarding of Saul's armor and the use of the 5 pebbles from the brook with which to slay the giant. The recognition of the principle by which God works. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. What are these weapons? The preaching of the word and prayer. And that goes alongside Paul's well-known statement in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, when he said to the Corinthians, I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. But my preaching was in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. You see, the weak things enable the man who uses them and who embodies them to trust wholly in the God whose strength is made perfect in weakness. Now, this is high ground. High ground for David also, and ground that he was sometimes tempted to draw back from. But when he was truest to his ideal, he was most what God wanted him to be, and most effective for God. And that's something that is in much need of being underlined today. I spoke to a young Christian recently who had attended a particular Christian gathering, and I asked him what it was like, and he said, "It was just a circus, and every conceivable kind of electronic gadgetry was employed, and it was just a circus, and I was appalled." That was his attitude. That was his verdict. James Denny's words, preached many decades ago now, still, it seemed to me, have validity today. In a sermon on wrong ways to the kingdom, on the temptations of Jesus, he says, "There is always a tendency in the church to trust to methods which appeal rather to the senses than to the soul, or which are believed to be reaching the soul, though they never get past the sense. They may be cruder or more refined, sensational, or connected with the symbolic side of worship, but the common character of all is that they fall short of being rational and spiritual." How tempting it is to trust in such impressions, as though the coming of the kingdom were really secured by them. No doubt such things make an impression and have an influence, but they are not the influence and the impression through which the kingdom of God can come, for which Jesus lived and died. And then this: how little Jesus had of all that the churches are tempted to trust in now. How little there is in the Gospels about methods and apparatus. Jesus had no church or hall. He spoke in the synagogues when he had the opportunity, but as willingly and prevailingly in the fields or by the seashore, in a boat or a private house. He had no choir, no vestments, no sacraments, and we may well believe he would look with more than amazement upon the importance which many of his disciples now attached to such things. He spake the word unto them. That was all. The trust of the church in other things is really a distrust of the truth, an unwillingness to believe that truth's power lies in itself, a desire to have something more irresistible than truth to plead truth's cause. And all these are modes of atheism. And if that's true, there's an awful lot of atheism in the Church of God today. It is not only a mistake, but a sin, to trust to attractions for the ear and the eye, and to draw people to the church by the same methods by which they are drawn to places of entertainment. What the evangelist calls the word, the spiritual truth, the message of the Father and of his kingdom, spoken in the Spirit and enforced by the Spirit, told by faith and heard by faith, is our only real resource, and we must not be ashamed of its simplicity. The weak things of God. Thirdly, and more briefly, the matter of typology and great David's greater son. It's certainly no accident and hardly surprising that so much in David's story reminds us of spiritual issues in the gospel, and indeed of Christ himself. And there are two points in particular to underline in this connection. In the first, we need to note the representative character of this encounter. Goliath said in his challenge, "If he, your champion, the Israelite champion, be able to fight with me and to kill me, then will we be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us. Victory for either of the champions then was to count. It was agreed as victory for the entire army which he represented. And when David slew Goliath, the Philistines recognized their own defeat in his, and the Israelites recognized their victory in David's victory. And the victory of Christ on the cross over sin and Satan partakes of this representative character also in the same way. And this is why Paul is able to say in Romans chapter 5, as we've studied some time ago, the things he does about the two heads of humanity, Adam and Christ. Adam lost his battle with Satan in the garden, and all humanity lost in him and fell with him. Christ, the second Adam, won his battle with the powers of darkness, and all who are in him win the victory in him. And that's what Paul means in 2 Corinthians 5 when he says, we thus judge that if one died for all, then we're all dead. And it's this principle, in fact, that underlines all the Pauline teaching on sanctification. And a true grasp of it is really an essential prerequisite of the true Christian life of victory, to understand what is ours in the victory of Christ, where we stand in him, where God has placed us in the death and resurrection of his Son. That's the secret of Christian life and Christian victory, the glorious liberty of the children of God. That's the first thing. This is a representative thing which reflects and foreshadows the representative victory of Christ. And the second thing is this. The representative character of David, fighting not for himself alone, but for the whole nation, is analogous to the representative character of Christ. And the shout, and I'm quoting, the shout that burst from the ranks of Israel and Judah when they saw the champion of the Philistines fall and the enemy betake themselves in consternation to flight, foreshadowed the joy of the redeemed man when the reality of Christ's salvation flashes on his heart and he sees the enemies that have been harassing him repulsed and scattered. Now, that's how we need to think in spiritual terms, and this story is God's picture book illustration of the situation. When Goliath was slain, the Philistine hosts recognized that in his death they had been defeated, and they fled the field. And the Israelites on their part recognized that in David's triumph they had triumphed, and they acted accordingly. And that's how it is with the gospel. A second Adam to the fight and to the rescue came. Now, the question that arises is, have we seen the gospel in this light? Have we entered into our champion's victory and triumph, realizing that it is our victory and triumph in him, that he won it for us, that he gives it to us? Thanks be to God, says Paul, who giveth us the victory. These words are meant to be taken literally. The victory that he won was not won on his own behalf. He didn't need a victory over the powers of darkness. He is immeasurably above them. But he won it for us, to give to us. Here he says, take it. It's yours. The time is gone and we must leave the giants of today. But there's more than enough in this chapter to enable us to say that the Spirit of God whispers in our hearts that this is a parable of how the great giants that beset us in the Christian warfare can be dealt with and set at naught. And perhaps the forays of the church into battle with the giants of today in modern society would be more effective if there was more of this kind of spiritual discipline behind it. David's disavowal of the armor of Saul is a reminder that we do not fight the Lord's battles with the weapons of the world. Do not let us try to do so. Our weapons are foolishness to our enemies, both outside and inside the church. But God chooses them to confound the mighty. There are forms of atheism, as Denny says, in the life of the church today that have to be eschewed, and we need to get back to a fundamental belief in the weapons of our warfare that God has given us, that are spiritual and mighty through God to the pulling down of the strongholds of Satan. May God bless his word to us. Now let us sing hymn number 576. Who would true valor see, let him come hither. One here will constant be, come wind, come weather. This is the hymn which speaks of fighting with giants. No lion can him fright, but he with a giant fight, but will have a right to be a pilgrim. 576.